Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington. Ahead, the U.S. president reflects on talks with Gulf partners. HRW reports on alleged Egyptian security torture. A look at British Queen Elizabeth's legacy on her birthday. And the Canadian pop reggae group Magic has a new CD coming out.
Reggae is just attached to me. I can't seem to get bored of it yet. So definitely the reggae is a big part of this album again.
It's right here on the Voice of America. U.S. President Barack Obama and Gulf state leaders have been meeting in Riyadh on ways they can work more closely to help stabilize the conflict-ridden Middle East region, despite differences on the best way forward. Afterward, the president met with members of the news media. White House correspondent Mary Alice Salinas was traveling with the president and is on the line now. Hi, Mary. Alice.
Hello, Susan.
Hey, what did the president have to say?
Well, I think what he really wanted to play up was that they have decided to continue to move forward together and dealing with all the problems that are plaguing the Persian area and the Middle East. That is the bottom line. And he really, there are differences and there have been disagreements. We've read that in the media all over the world. He acknowledged that, but he said in some remarks afterwards that it had been overblown. They had agreed to work together. He reassured the Gulf partners that the U.S. is committed to their security. And that was a key question because of some remarks Obama made. There were some speculation about the state of relations, especially with Saudi Arabia. So he wanted to quell that and reassure the partners there that they're committed to the fight, but he also wanted to hear from them that they're more committed to the fight against Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, which is the number one priority for the United States.
All along, you've been telling us that nothing too concrete would come out of these talks, but it was important, nevertheless, for these officials to get together.
It was. It really is to publicly demonstrate that they're united in this, that they're working together, that they're coordinating, that they're integrating their approaches. And that was a big thing. And so that they have different priorities and strategies, but they are coming together to say, look, we're working to align those. We're going to keep this up. There was a sense that everybody felt better. Just talking it out made it better. And the U.S. did say that they would work with their Arab partners so that they would have special ops forces that can coordinate better. That's very important because the U.S. feels that the kinds of military capabilities that Arab partners have here in the Persian Gulf are not really what are needed today for the asymmetrical warfare that we see with groups like Islamic State. You know, you don't need major, air power and those kinds of things. You need special ops forces who can go on the ground, take out leaders, gather intelligence, and that kind of thing. So the U.S. says, we're committed to helping you all advance your militaries in that way.
Well, what is the sentiment among others attending the conference? Was everybody pretty pleased with it?
I think the expectations were not for much more than what came out of it, which was just ongoing discussion and a commitment to continue to discuss. So I think that everyone feels essentially better. That is something that somebody, it's just talking it out. And that one thing the president says is when you have so much happen in 1 year and you don't get together and talk about it, there are going to be a lot of misunderstandings. It sounds like relationships between people, but it's that way between countries too. And so they got to talk about a lot of the things they're concerned about and where they want to go with it. And then also to show what they feel are rumors or overblown reports and those kinds of things. So I think they were satisfied.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mary Alice, for speaking with us from Riyadh today.
It is my pleasure, Susan. Thank you.
Our social media reporter, Andrew Palchevsky, has come flying into the studio. He has some very sad and shocking and surprising news from the field of entertainment, and it happens to involve one of the artists that I particularly enjoyed in my youth.
And I've enjoyed him as well. Singer Prince has been reported to have died at the age of 57, found dead in Minnesota, where he made his home. So this news is breaking just now on social media, reported by TMZ, the entertainment website, first. So we're seeing RIP Prince, hashtag RIP Prince, quickly being used by a number of people. The news is still breaking as we speak, so we're seeing, you know, people in disbelief saying, you know, we're hoping these rumors aren't true, we're hoping the news isn't accurate, but it's apparently, allegedly by TMZ, been confirmed. Apparently he just performed, you know, last week, and he had a, you know, a flu that he said he was battling, but otherwise said he was fine. But really shocking news.
So we don't know the details of it all, and it has not been completely confirmed by VOA. But Prince was well known for things like Purple Rain, for his outrageous, unique personality. He was a real character personality in the field, and he was a good dancer.
Yeah, and he was, you know, one of these unique entertainers that, you know, one of those people that could go by one name and get away with that.
Yes, and he had a way of writing his music that was special, too. I don't know there was anybody else like him.
Yeah, no, for sure. And that's what we're seeing just very, very early on in this announcement, that people are remembering his music, sharing favorite songs and things.
You remember he had that period of time when he had a conflict with his company, and he didn't want to be called Prince anymore.
He was the artist formerly known as Prince,
yes.
And he had a kind of a symbol that he used.
Yes.
But so it's this news as it's breaking, as we said, reported by TMZ and several other outlets. Looks like they've confirmed CBS News here in the U.S. as well. Very sad news about the passing of Prince.
Well, thank you very much, Andrew, and our condolences go to him, his family.
Absolutely.
Okay, this is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The LIGO Scientific Collaboration announced the first detection of gravitational waves that pass through our planet on September 14, 2015. The waves of energy that traveled for 1.3 billion years were produced by the merger of two black holes. NASA scientists say that less than a half second after the gravitational waves rocked the fabric of space-time, the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope was able to detect a quick and weak pulse of high-energy light from the same area of space. NASA says this would be a remarkable discovery, since mergers of black holes are thought to happen without producing any kind of light. While their analysis indicates that this burst of energy has just a 0.2% chance of being coincidence, the scientists say they'll need additional observations before they can firmly associate spurts of high-energy X-rays with gravitational waves from black hole mergers. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Egyptian security forces allegedly tortured a group of 20 people, some children, in February after an arrest sweep in Alexandria, according to Human Rights Watch. On the line with us is a senior HRW researcher who prefers to remain anonymous because of his work in the region is continuing. Welcome to our program.
Thanks very much for having me.
What does your report say?
Well, we interviewed family members, lawyers, and some victims of an arrest sweep in the Egyptian city of Alexandria that occurred in February. And they told us that the detainees were arrested, in some cases taken out of their beds at gunpoint. And the families didn't know their whereabouts for more than a week. They were essentially victims of enforced disappearances. It turns out that they were actually taken to a government building, a security directorate in Alexandria, where the authorities refused to acknowledge detaining them. It's not an official place of detention. And they were tortured brutally. The six people that we interviewed, they were tortured terribly with electric shocks, being suspended in very painful positions for a very long time before they were eventually released to official custody. And then, after that happened, the police faked records claiming that they had been detained and arrested only the day before they were turned over to the official system. Now, this is something that's been going on in Egypt for quite some time, but we hadn't ourselves documented large numbers of children being caught up in these sorts of sweeps before. Most of these people have now been released, but some of them were only released 2 days ago, and five people who were victims of this arrest sweep are still in custody.
Why would the officials do this?
It's an extremely effective method to terrorize and terrify people. if you want to get information out of them. However, the type of information being sought was basically, from what we can tell, lists of names. Who are your friends? Who else might be a sympathizer to the banned Muslim Brotherhood? Who may have taken part in acts of vandalism that occurred in Alexandria shortly before this arrest sweep occurred? That sort of thing. So it's a terrifying method where you don't think you're ever going to see your family again. You haven't had access to a lawyer. You have no one to call and no one knows where you are. You may cough up more names.
I know you spoke with victims of this case reportedly, but have you had anything else to confirm this with?
We have these cases have been documented independently by a number of Egyptian human rights groups and media sources. And we talked to a number of lawyers and family members over the course of the months since these arrests occurred. So we also spoke to them independently, and the consistency of their testimony, the consistency of the findings by the other groups, and what the lawyers told us. In some cases, the lawyers were the first people able to see the detainees and saw some marks of torture on their bodies. All that high consistency of independent sources led us to believe that this was quite credible and very serious.
Have you gotten any response back from the Egyptian government?
We haven't seen any response yet, but we'll be watching that. The Egyptian authorities have had a variety of responses to, you know, persistent allegations that disappearances have been increasing over the last year or so. Initially, it was a flat denial that eventually morphed into an acknowledgement that around 120 or 130 people, there were 130 or so cases of disappearances that were acknowledged. But that was also, that acknowledgement was accompanied by something of a dismissal with the claim that in a country of Egypt's size, such disappearances are just the norm and people shouldn't get too upset about it.
Well, thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We agreed not to name the HRW researcher because of the importance of this story in the region and for concern for his personal security.
I think she has done what her parents did and her grandparents and her great-grandparents.
Coming up on International Edition, a nod to the legacy of Britain's Queen Elizabeth and a new pop reggae CD to look forward to. Britain's Queen Elizabeth, on the throne for 64 years, is celebrating her 90th birthday at Windsor Castle with official engagements and dinner with the royal family. The Queen, who surpassed her great-great-great-grandmother, Queen Victoria, last year as the longest-reigning monarch, was hailed by Prime Minister David Cameron as steadfast, a rock of strength for the nation who has lived through historic times, including the sunset of the British Empire. She remains admired worldwide, especially in the Commonwealth of Nations, including Australia, where the National Convener of Australians for a Constitutional Monarchy, law professor emeritus David Flint, spoke via Skype with VOA's Victor Beatty about the Queen's legacy of service.
I think she has done what her parents did and her grandparents and her great-grandparents and what her grandchildren are doing, and that is she represents service. And I think that's best encapsulated by her mother. Her mother, during the Second World War, when Nazi bombs were raining down on London, it was suggested that the children, the royal children, that is the present Queen and her sister, Princess Margaret, be sent to Canada. Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, said, "They won't go without me. I won't go without the King, and the King will never leave London." There was that sense of service, that they would stay there with their people, put up with the privations of the people, even accepting rationing, that they would do this. And her whole life has been about service. When she turned 21, she was in South Africa, and she made a broadcast to the then Empire and Commonwealth in which she said, "My whole life, whether it be long or short, shall be dedicated to your service and the great Commonwealth and imperial family to which we all belong." And she has been very faithful to that.
What about the future of the monarchy in Britain after her reign is complete?
I think it'll always be there in the United Kingdom, and the strong support, particularly for the younger members of the royal family who seem to also be dedicated to service, is there. In fact, I remember reading an American comment about them and saying how wonderful it was. the heirs, the future generation of the royal family, are dedicating themselves also to military service, with Harry going off to Afghanistan. There used to be a view in Australia among Republicans that change was inevitable, Australia being seen as the country most likely among the realms, the 15 realms which had the Queen as their monarch, to become a republic. And we found at the time of the 1999 referendum that if you looked at people according to their age, it was the middle-aged who were the most republican, and the strongest monarchists were the elderly. We found an extraordinary development over the last 3 or 4 years. Not only has support for change fallen to a low level, it's now in the 30 percentile range. That's for people who say they'd like change to a vague, undefined republic. Nowadays, young people are challenging the elderly as the strongest supporters of the constitutional monarchy. So the future seems that not only will we see the reign of Elizabeth II and Charles III and William V, we'll probably also see the reign of George VII.
Two recent public opinion surveys in Britain find that a vast majority of Britons wants her to remain on the throne. The Queen, who began her reign in 1952, hosts President Obama for lunch at Windsor Castle Friday. He has described her as a source of strength and inspiration, not only for the people of Britain, but for millions around the world. U.S. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew has called it an exciting moment to announce that 19th century abolitionist Harriet Tubman will appear on the front of the $20 bill, the first African-American to be so honored. Lew said it is the first in a series of steps to redesign American currency.
Harriet Tubman is one of the great American stories. A woman born a slave, illiterate for her whole life, she brought many, many people out of slavery through the Underground Railroad by time and again risking her own life to save others. She did intelligence for our army during the Civil War. She worked to get the women's suffrage movement going. It's a great American story about how if you care about our democracy, it doesn't matter where you come from and it doesn't matter what you started out with. You can change our country. We're also going to be changing the 5 and the 10. And on the back of the 10, we're going to tell the story of women's suffrage more generally with the leaders of the suffrage movement and a demonstration on the steps of the Treasury building for the women's right to vote. On the back of the 5, we're going to bring to life the Lincoln Memorial with iconic events that have really changed our country.
Lew said the target date for the redesigns, which will employ the most modern anti-counterfeiting technology, is 2020, the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage in the U.S., and circulation will begin after that. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? It's called the Happy Slide. It's in Shanghai, China. It's 54 meters long. It's 20 meters high. It's an amusement slide. People who have tested the Happy Slide may quibble with the happy part, like Liu Zhe, for instance.
I was really scared because during those bends, my hands felt numb.
And it wasn't any better for Liu Shenwei.
I felt terrified, especially at the bends.
Liu Haiying, one of the ride's designers, says the Happy Slide isn't all that bad. As a matter of fact, she says it's not scary enough.
It gets lots of fun. I'm not scared at all. Sometimes I even think it isn't exciting enough.
Only people between the ages of 7 and 50 and in good health may use the Happy Slide. The slide can be found in the New World Department Store Mall in Shanghai's Pudong District. And visitors can load up on all the terror they can stand because the Happy Slide is free. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossons.
The Canadian pop reggae group Magic will have a new CD coming out July 1st, Primary Colors. It's the band's second CD after their first effort, Don't Kill the Magic, peaked at number 6 on the Billboard album charts. International Edition's David Byrd reports the group is hoping Primary Colors will keep fans bouncing along.
Their first CD vaulted Magic to stardom with its smash hit, Rude. The record spent 6 weeks at number 1 on the Billboard Hot 100. It sold 3.3 million downloads and had 313 million on-demand streams, according to Nielsen Music. That's a tough act to follow. But band leader Nasri Atwe says that he hopes Primary Colors doesn't fall under the sophomore curse, where a second album doesn't do as well as the first.
Do you know what? Like, I kind of, at first, when people ask me the question, I was like, no, I feel no pressure. I'm a rock. But, you know, I got this personality trait from my mother, which is like the worry bone, you know? I'm kind of a worrier. And yeah, of course I worried about it, you know, and I worry about it because I don't want to stop.
Atwe and his writing partner, Adam Messinger, had success writing for other acts like Justin Bieber and Shakira. He formed Magic 4 years ago with guitarist Mark Pelizer, bassist Ben Spivak, and drummer Alex Tanis. Though the group has experimented with other genres, their infectious reggae sound is what brought them to stardom. Atwe says that's a reflection of his love for the island-flavored music.
I'm pretty impatient, you know, with you know, sticking to one thing, but reggae is just attached to me. I can't seem to get bored of it yet. So definitely the reggae is a big part of this album again. And then there's this other side of it. There's this kind of little 80s vibe to some of the songs, too. That's a lot of fun. There's a song called Gloria. That's about this like cheating girl named Gloria. Fictional story. A lot of fun. You know, kind of, I call it Magic meets ABBA.
I'm trying to lay you down easy. Check me out, girl. I'm at the magic floor. Check my word. Now I know you don't.
For Primary Colors, Atwe integrated the sounds of rapper Sean Paul. The first single, Lay You Down Easy, debuted at number one on the Billboard Reggae Digital Songs chart. Its official music video is closing in on 1.5 million global views on YouTube. The 35-year-old Atwe says that for Primary Colors, the band didn't want to rest on its previous success with Rude.
It was like everything. It was like having, even with relationships, you know, like, hey, we should start over right from scratch, Primary Colors, and mix again. Or even creatively, like going back to basics, just writing a pop song instead of like overthinking it. Let's mix the basics. And it just was kind of like the through line. And it sounds cool, you know, to me.
Nasri Atwe says Primary Colors also features what he calls urban folk and a tune he describes as reggae Coldplay. Primary Colors is set for release July 1st. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Jamal Mohammed al-Badawi is a fugitive who was wanted in connection with the October 2000 attack on the USS Cole, a U.S. naval vessel moored at the time in the harbor of Aden, Republic of Yemen. A Yemeni native, al-Badawi is a small man, standing 5'5" tall with black hair and dark eyes, and weighs about 175 pounds. He is 48 years old and also known as Jamal Mushin al-Tali, Abu Abdal Rahman al-Adani, and Jamal Mohammed Ahmad. The attack on the USS Cole resulted in the deaths of 17 American sailors. For this and other actions, al-Badawi is charged with murder, conspiracy to use weapons of mass destruction, providing material support for terrorist groups, and other crimes. He was being held by Yemeni authorities in connection with the attack when he escaped in April 2003. He was recaptured the next year, but escaped again in February 2006. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to al-Badawi's arrest or prosecution. The U.S. guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on this man, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.